Welcome to the Sports Science Dudes. I'm your host, Dr. Jose Antonio, with my co-host, Dr. Anthony Ricci. If you're a first-time listener, hit the subscribe button and like the show. You can find us on YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Our special guest today is Dr. Susan J. Hewlings. She's a PhD RD. Your bio is quite long, so I had to like compress it a little. When we've been in this business long enough, it's sort of like we could write an entire dissertation just on our bio. But anyhow, so you have over 20 years of research, teaching, and medical writing experience in nutrition, sports nutrition, as well as scientific consulting for the dietary supplement, food, beverage, and medical industries. You also got your PhD, your master's degree, and your BS from Florida State University. Oh, they have a really good football team this year, Tony. Do you know that?
They're out of the top five now, I think, right? Or number four?
Yeah. But they're still, they're still pretty damn good. And I didn't know you actually completed a research fellowship at University of Texas Medical Branch. Was that with Bob Wolf?
It was.
Oh, yes. Wow. Pretty cool. And you've also had former faculty positions at Stetson University, which, by the way, is a very beautiful campus.
It is.
University of Central Florida College of Medicine and Central Michigan University. You recently earned a graduate certificate, and I find this quite interesting, in cannabis science from the University of Vermont Medical School. So all you cannabis fans, we got to hear about that.
No doubt.
You've also written a textbook titled Nutrition, Real People, Real Choices, and you've published many book chapters and manuscripts in peer-reviewed journals. And you've also, you're also the founder of a nonprofit animal rescue, and I love animals, the ARF Shack, which is a 501c3. So that's pretty cool. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hewlings. It's good to have you on.
It's great to be here. It's great to be one of the dudes. Thanks.
And that's amazing that was your condensed bio, by the way. I want everybody to know that.
Okay. Hey, how about this? Just real briefly, because we have two dogs and anywhere up to 9 cats in our house. So what is the ARF Shack? And I know you wish you could spend more time with it, but just tell the audience because I think it's cool.
Yeah, of everything you said, which thing is my favorite? Good place to start. Yes, I started the ARF Shack. Well, I feel like I've been rescuing and wanting to rescue animals my whole life, but I started the rescue officially in 2009. And when I lived in Orlando and was at Stetson and UCF, I ran a huge rescue. I had like 40 dogs at a time in the rescue and would have them in foster homes. And we'd do like the Petco adoption things on the weekend. When I moved to the Keys, I had to downsize because I was the primary funder. So I had to downsize. But for a long time, for many, many years, I had 6 dogs of my own. And then I would foster dogs here and there. And I'm always, and if somebody's looking for a certain kind of dog, I'm always like, don't buy it. I can find it for you. I don't care what kind of purebred dog you want. Do not buy it from a breeder. I can find you a rescue dog. Just give me time. And so I do a lot of that. And then right now I have 3 dogs of my own. Wish I had more, but I made a bargain with my boyfriend that I can't back out of.
Now, do you ever have sausage dogs that require rescuing? Because my wife loves dachshunds.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I do. And I can usually get any dog that someone's looking for, if they're willing to, just be a little patient, I can find a purebred dog. Yeah.
All right, cool. And what's the website for people who are interested?
I don't have a website anymore. Oh. It's just small. You can find me on Facebook. That's pretty much where I keep it, just because it got to be too much of one person by myself. And then it became like more of people looking to surrender dogs than it was people looking to adopt dogs. I took the website down. I just do it small for now, but pretty much have my retirement figured out. So there you have it.
Oh, very cool. No, hey, anyone who rescues animals is a friend of mine. So I think that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I want to read something. This is a publication. This is something you wrote. It was published in the Journal of Cardiovascular Development and Disease. And I think, Tony, you'll have an interesting sort of side story to this because you worked at Pfizer. And I read it, Tony, you'll understand what I'm talking about. And then I want Susan to comment on it. So I'm just going to read it verbatim so that we're on the same track. This is what you wrote. There's a longstanding dogma in public health nutrition that elevated serum total cholesterol, particularly LDL-C, increases risk of cardiovascular disease / coronary heart disease. It is also believed that HDL cholesterol decreases the risk. connected to this longstanding deduction that increased intake of saturated fat increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, recommendations to decrease saturated fat intake have been part of recommendations for decreasing cardiovascular risk. And the American Heart Association and other major organizations have recommended that individuals decrease their saturated fat intake to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. So there's a lot there. And I know, Tony, you and I have talked about the lipid hypothesis, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess tell us the story of why you decided to write this and what are the misconceptions around the different kinds of fats vis-a-vis we need to drop saturated fat intake.
Well, I think it's oversimplified is the bottom line. Like if I had, it's just oversimplified because it's not, and it's not nearly as black and white as it's made to appear, right? And I think with the motivation to your original question, what's the motivation for writing it? Well, the motivation is surrounding really kind of started with coconut and the idea that coconut gets lumped into that saturated fat message, right? And so it's the idea that all the saturated fats, any that are, you know, regardless of their chain length or their, you know, their saturated chain length, they're all the same and they're all going to have the same implications on health, right? And there's the oversimplification kind of just represents a lack of really thorough understanding and investigation of where that information came from. Nutritional epidemiology, right? The limitations of nutritional epidemiological research are kind of unrecognized within that black and white statement. So it came from several different angles, but the base angle was just from coconuts. So I sit on the Coconut Coalition for Transparency. Okay. And
I didn't know there was a coalition.
There's a coalition for everything, you know that. So yeah, and it's really ironic that I sit on the Coconut Coalition because first of all, I don't like coconuts and I've spent a lot of time and money trying to get them out of my yard. Because they're, you know how it gets, you know.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
I'm afraid it'll drop on my head and crush my skull.
Yeah, well, I'm worried about the dog, not me. Mm. And in my dog, the area of my yard I have for my dogs is all palm trees, so I'm always removing coconuts. But anyway, nonetheless, that's where it came from, and the idea that the message needed to be rethought, re-messaged. It's not as black and white as to say, well, no, saturated fats aren't bad for you. You should be eating saturated fat. It's just the idea of like, listen, we recognize that different types of polyunsaturated fats had different effects on health, right? Like we differentiated N6 and N3 in public health messaging. And then saturated fats just sit there like they're all the same. And, you know, it's kind of like eating meat is all the same. Like if you right. eat processed, you know, if you eat processed high fat meat, it's the same as, you know, leaner sources of meat. It's not the same. And I think some of that is natural and normal and kind of how the evolution of that epidemiological research unravels too, right? Like we develop as those studies developed and that science developed, they also developed more sophisticated statistical analyses and ways to sort of comb that out and look at that because it's complicated when you start looking at that stuff. Right. Plus it's like it's not isolated. Very few people that's the only thing they do that's going to be like negative towards their health, right? It's this complex right. interaction. And we're really just scratching the surface on all that stuff. So I wanted to just back it up and say, let's look at the fact that not all saturated fats are the same. And they're not the same in chemistry. And therefore, it kind of makes sense that they wouldn't be the same on how they affect your health. So that's the beat.
What would be some examples of saturated fat that are treated differently? I know, like, for instance, I think stearic acid, which is in red meat, tends to be lipid neutral. What would be supposedly other saturated fats that would cause, I don't know, hyperlipidemia?
Well, I think that, you know, off the top of my head, you know, I'd have to look because we don't have, that's the whole point is that we don't have the research that can comb it out that well. Plus, very few foods only have one of those things in there, right? They're usually right. combinations. So even the high stearic acid, the saturated fat sources like meats that have high stearic acid in it are going to also have other saturated fats in it. But when you look at the vegetable sources like coconut, you know, or vegetable or fruit, I mean, sources, when you look at those, they usually have the medium or shorter chain saturated fats. And so that's kind of where, as far as it's gotten. And so the idea is to start in two places, look at not all of them are the same and that maybe the messaging needs to be rethought and redetailed. So yeah, so what we didn't do is get granular into, okay, stearic acid versus right. this acid versus right. that. We didn't get granular there. And from our investigation, because again, I don't actually do the research. I'm doing more of like, I did a systematic review and a review paper. But there are some people, so Toby Dayrit, who I've partnered with on several things, he is a chemist and is pushing the nomenclature from the chemistry side in a way that's like way over my head, and saying that even the way we name it, like the stearic acids and the way we learned it in nutrition right. class needs to be rethought. Like we need yeah. to start there. So yeah, there's several different disciplines that are reevaluating the message. It's kind of interesting.
What about the connection between the consumption of saturated fat and lowering or increasing LDL cholesterol and or total cholesterol? And is there, Tony and I have talked about this, should those of us who work out, don't have any comorbidities, but have a cholesterol over 200, should we care?
Should you care? I would say yes, but should the way you care be that you have to like be overly diligent about your saturated fat intake? I would say probably not, because I've been around the two of you and those people like you long enough to realize probably if I look at your diet at a whole, it's pretty damn healthy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So I'm going to say probably not. If somebody has higher, their cholesterol on the higher side, there's some things you can add to your diet, right? You can phytosterols or something, but people haven't talked about phytosterols in a while, right? But like looking at higher fiber content or higher phytosterol content, adding some of those foods or supplements to your diet might be all you need to bring that down just a little bit. Do you need to bring it down? Is it going to have a huge impact on your health? That's where it's like, it's hard to say. I mean, it's not as definitive as we've been led to believe, right? The cholesterol hypothesis that you read in the beginning, that would lead us to believe like that I would be like, yes, absolutely. You must be scared and you must live. And I don't really think that's the case. And I think we're going to see that messaging change.
And a quick question on that, Sue. I mean, obviously endogenous production, right, is significant. I hear anything ranging from 65 to 85% of total cholesterol being endogenous. And that may vary as well from individual to individual. Mm-hmm. But assuming all other markers, triglycerides are good, sugar is good, A1C, anything else associated with, MI or heart disease, assuming they are good, do we think there is rationale in the body's design as to why I might be making 250 milligrams per deciliter? Is it needed? I mean, and because my whole family on my mom's side, I don't know if anyone ever tested under 280, and I don't think anyone's ever lived less than 98 years old. So somewhere along that line, there is a reason, or the body's doing it because the demand is greater. Do we know anything about that? Or
And you raise an excellent point, because you really do have to, like, what you just said is you have to look at the whole health profile. Mm-hmm. You can't just look at one aspect of it. What you're suggesting, I don't know. I've never seen anything suggesting that, but it makes a lot of sense. Right. And it also, of course, looking at particle size, which is something we've known about for a while, but still isn't being done in routine testing, to look at particle size and to look at the whole health history. And is there family history of heart disease? Because it makes sense. There might be that's just your norm. And mm-hmm. I think it also speaks to the idea of like getting it tested, not waiting until you're 50 or 60 years old to get it tested. Like if you establish your own norm when you're young and that's just where it is, it really supports what you're saying.
Good point.
I did something when I was in undergrad in college, because my father was a physician. So oftentimes he would take my blood and send it to the lab just, as a checkup. But starting at age 19, I think I was a sophomore, I actually have all my blood work data from age 19, and I'm now 61. I have it every year, so I played around with my diet. Exercise has no effect, by the way, on any of the blood lipids for me. My HDL is always low. It's always 35 to 40. Doesn't change. Doesn't matter what I do. diet, cholesterol, total cholesterol, none of that changes no matter what my diet is. The only thing that changes is triglycerides. So for me, I have figured out, it's taken me, you know, decades. This sounds funny. If I eat less rice, triglycerides go down. If I eat more rice, triglycerides go up. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, well, so you just raised it. You just raised a great point about like taking control of your own health, like via biomarkers, right? That's not something a lot of people have the opportunity to do per se, but it's becoming more available for people to do that, right? Because you can get the home kits. You don't have to go in and get a big expensive, like, oh my God, I hope I have insurance, blood panel. You can use home testing. There's a lot of good stuff out there for finger pricks or salivary biomarkers, depending on which biomarker we're talking about. And also LabCorp has a great functional medicine profile. I mean, you have to get a functional medicine or other doc to order it for you, but it's outside of your insurance. It's $250 and it runs everything. All the subparticles, the magnesium, the vitamin D, everything. So you really have to do it to be almost your own health researcher and do what you can. You're not alone. I have all mine. I have them on like my cholesterol from my early 20s and stuff on like a, you know, the purple, what was it called? Like a dot matrix where the printer with the purple ink.
Oh my God. Those printers. I think that's like going back to, oh my God, maybe Bush one was the president or something.
I don't even know, but I have all of them too. So you're not the only one out there.
hey, Tony, tell Susan a story about when you were at Pfizer and there was a patent that ran out on, I think it was a, Oh, you're muted.
Yep. It was a little background noise, so forgive me. I didn't want to make sure I didn't get on. I worked there for a long time, about 14 years, and I was in the health and wellness department, health promotions. But obviously, I didn't think moving from a 220 cholesterol in the mail down to 120 was probably really the way to go. Not that I had any data. It just didn't make sense to me. So also, I felt when every other marker and all other factors looked good, I don't want to say hypercholesterolemia was BS, but that's kind of where I was going with it. So the day Lipitor did run off patent, I felt compelled to run through the hallways and tell everybody, okay, total cholesterol in isolate is BS. So now we can make sure that everybody knows that. Mine's 280. I'm going to try to get it higher if I can and still live to 100. I was being somewhat of a wise guy, Sue, but I didn't think that, again, like if mine is naturally in the higher range, where would be the advantage in moving me down 100 milligrams per deciliter with all other factors? No calcium score good, triglycerides good, blood sugar good, A1C good. So I was hesitant to ever take it. It was recommended for me. The statins were recommended for a sustained period of time, but I didn't want to go from 220, 230, potentially down to 120 and decrease all endogenous production because I kind of felt my body may have been okay with staying at that level. All other factors were great.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You have to look at the big picture on everything and your family history cannot be ignored in that regard either. But I think like that is, you are the exception. Very rarely are people going to have only hypercholesterolemia, right? Okay, I mean, that's why we have metabolic syndrome. And so I think when you look at the general population and you look at like that data that they run those correlations, right? The correlation statistics on, they're usually not, you're the outlier.
Right.
And so that's where some of it comes from too. We try to isolate something that doesn't occur in isolation. We're trying to say the person with high triglycerides is at risk when in actuality, there's so much else going on there. I'm fascinated by epidemiological research because there's so many moving pieces. And, you know, I think when I first started teaching it and I really started digging in to it, I was like, wow, all these public health messages that we put so much weight on and that drive whole industries, like even the people that collect, you look at any of the stuff that Walter Willett's run and stuff where he really tries to talk about what it is and what the limitations are, that gets lost in translation. And I think that was kind of the interest that led me to that paper because saturated fat is not my area of expertise. It's not my, you know, something I've ever done research in or anything like that. So it was like just interesting to me when they asked me to write the paper to try to kind of change the message and the narrative. So,
yeah. Yeah, and I think the difficulty is, and obviously you guys know this, is, you know, I tell my students all the time, nobody opens a refrigerator and says, I think I'll have saturated fat today. You know, they might eat a piece of meat, they might eat eggs, or they might eat bread or whatever, fried rice, who the hell knows. But, you know, we eat foods and we eat mixed meals. No one eats just polyunsaturated or saturated fat or you know, simple sugars. And I think that's where, and that's, I think, one of the drawbacks with nutritional epidemiology is we're looking at these molecules, basically, to see if they can predict something, when in fact, if you look throughout the world, I mean, look at one of the healthiest populations is in Japan. I mean, they eat a lot of carbs. I mean, certainly more than, as a percentage, more than Americans, and obesity is rare. They're quite
healthy. The highest lifespan, too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so when people make fun of rice, I'm like, look at Japan, damn it. Don't make fun of my rice.
Don't make fun. Yeah, I'm with you. Don't make fun of my rice, for sure. Yeah, no doubt. And I think the other thing, to Tony's previous job, cannot ignore the impact of a multi-billion-dollar industry, right? That's right. Like, you know, in Europe, when someone has hypercholesterolemia, phytosterols are the first line of addressing it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's look at adding phytosterol supplementation. People don't even really talk about that right now in the U.S. Don't. They go right to the statins. They don't even give you a chance. They don't even give you a chance to address it with diet at all, exercise at all, weight loss. Right on the statins. And, you know, that's the part we need to start having more conversations about, is like, no. There are other options first. Now, granted, if somebody is really has a strong family history and they've got a cholesterol of like, you know, 380 and the subfractions don't look good, everything looks, you know, maybe then. And I'm certainly no cardiologist by any means, but it's just a conversation we need to bring up front, is that there's got to be better lines of defense. And maybe that helps drive, who knows, maybe these kind of papers and these kind of discussions help to drive further drug development, so we're not all just here on statins all the time.
Right.
Now, both of you know that in our industry, there's, it's very bandwagonish. People will jump on bandwagons, you know, like recently, it's you got to do cold plunging because it does X, Y, and Z, or maybe you need to get in the sauna. And it wasn't that long ago that people were like, coconuts are the best, healthiest food ever. Great source of fat. We all need coconuts. And unlike you, I actually, I don't like coconuts per se, but I like things that taste like coconut ice cream, you know, coconut cake. But I don't really eat coconuts. So what do you think of the fat in coconut? And is there anything that is, I don't want to use the word magical, but people treat coconut fat like it's magical. What is it about coconuts that would be worth, you know, telling someone to include that in their diet?
I think it offers, a good substitute for a lot of like higher long chain fats in the health benefits that it has. And it's plant-based, so it has other things included in it, other nutrients included in it. Certainly, if you're doing coconut water, it's a chance for hydration, has electrolytes and things like that. But nothing magical about it. My perspective from it was just like, let's not lump it in. It's not the same thing. Just like omega-3s and omega-6s aren't the same, right? They're polyunsaturated, sure, but they're not the same. But I don't think there's anything magical about it. And so that people that don't like it don't need to be, you know, going out of their way to include it. And I think that a lot of the products that were coming out in it were like lower in sugar, you know, because they were marketing them towards people who were trying to maximize the health benefits. Right. So there might be something in that regard. Like, so instead of drinking a Gatorade that's loaded with sugar or something like that, they're drinking a coconut drink and getting less sugar might be, you know, sort of a secondary advantage. But
right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, just quickly, conversely, there was a group that went the other way. It's the worst substance on earth for you, yeah. Right? And then why would you, you know, God forbid you ever even consider, there were two groups and right? There were two thoughts there. I mean, not just was it curing all, it was also causing everything according to another group, so.
No doubt. I was helping respond to some of that anti-coconut message. And at the end of the day, I'm like, oh God, yeah. I mean, you know, anybody, anytime that there is an extreme in one side or the other, right? Red flag goes up. Yeah, three of us have been exactly. around long enough. It's like, no, no, red flag. There's just nothing. If there was, you know, if there was a magic cure, we'd be doing it. So yeah, there just isn't one. And then it comes back to like, that, you know, it brings us back to that whole thing of like finding the right mix. Like Joey said, like we don't eat saturated fat. We don't eat this. That's the right balance of stuff. And I figure that anytime we can go more like whole food based or back to basics mm-hmm. and like the less ingredients we're consuming, like, okay, if you're going to drink coconut water, but like we live in Florida, would it be better just to like take your hatchet and cut the coconut yeah. and drink than buying something that's got a bunch of stuff added to it? Well, sure. But that's not what most people have. So then you look at, okay, what is there? What has the least amount of stuff added to it, least amount of sugar? That's going to be your best choice. Like it's always going back to whatever's the most natural. And, you know, I think that's kind of where you can bring it back to every, when the opposing sides get in your head and you're like, well, what do I do?
Speaking of fat, what are your thoughts on putting butter in your coffee?
That sounds absolutely disgusting is what my thoughts are. I hate both butter and coffee. So like, that is absolutely disgusting.
I wish I hated both. Life would be a lot easier. God.
So you're not a caffeine drinker?
I am not a caffeine drinker. I do like caffeine. I like caffeine supplements and I feel like very anti-American where people are like, do you want to meet for coffee? I'm like, yeah. I love the smell of coffee, but the taste of it, forget it. And I don't like tea and I don't like soda. So yeah, go figure. But, you know, I don't think it's going to hurt anybody. Nobody's putting so much butter in their coffee that like, I mean, I guess some people get extreme and they're drinking it all the time. Oh my God, I heard it was good for you, you know. But again, if you find yourself getting extreme on either side about anything, that's exactly. when you need to like check yourself. But a teaspoon of butter in your coffee, if you like it, I don't think it's going to hurt anybody. No. Yeah. Is there any advantage to it?
Probably. I think it's gross for one thing, but I do love coffee and I do love butter. In fact, butter on bread is delicious. Especially if it's warm French bread. It's delicious.
I what can I say? I'm weird like that.
Well, you know, we all live in the Sunshine State. In terms of vitamin D, because I've been asked this and I don't know the answer. Sun exposure versus supplementation with vitamin D. I've talked to people who don't go out in the sun for whatever reason. Maybe they're super pale or whatever. They don't want to burn. Apparently supplementing even very high dose vitamin D, it's very hard to bump up your levels. And I'm not sure, you probably know a lot more about this than I do. So sort of do the comparison sunshine versus vitamin D, because I used to take supplements. I don't anymore because I'm literally outside every day, maybe for at least an hour, and I don't put sunscreen on, so I am sunscreen free. So what are your thoughts on that from a practical level, and also what are the health effects of having it too low, and is there something, can you actually be too high?
Yeah, there's definitely both. So it's interesting because vitamin D, you know, it goes through, like you said, like at popular times where people's mm-hmm. COVID brought it back to popular mm-hmm. times because there was a ton of studies that were looking at the connection between vitamin D status and COVID. And I was part of the Vitamin D and Me project I did for CRN. We did a website that was kind of interesting whereby I did basically a systematic search of the literature on vitamin D and COVID-19. And I would update it every month. So, and I did it for like 2 years, and then all the studies got posted on that website. We didn't make any like summations or anything. We just put the studies mm-hmm. there, and I would write a summary of the study, like shorter than the abstract. So at first they were looking at vitamin D and whether or not it had any impact on whether you got COVID or not. Pretty much not really. But where they started to see the result is that it impacted people's outcomes. So it impacts your immune system. And vitamin D is a really cool vitamin because it's so unique. You know, they call it the hormone vitamin. Right. But one of the things that also makes it really unique is the fact that we have these vitamin D receptors throughout our bodies. And so it's a demonstration that vitamin D impacts all areas of our health. But the one that emerges at the top is immune function. And it really has a direct impact on immune function. And, you asked, well, if your levels are too low, what might you experience? Well, decreased immune function that can be measured by immune biomarkers, right? Fatigue, lethargy, A lot of muscle soreness, decreased recovery, because the muscle has the vitamin D receptors. So a lot of research done looking into saying, well, is this a connection with like chronic fatigue syndrome and all these things? Hard to say. And definitely a connection with the immune system. And then on the flip side, people who have too high of levels is not good either, because then that can affect calcium and bone, because vitamin D and calcium work in such a balance together that it can create an imbalance. But it is pretty rare for people to get high levels without like extreme supplementation. So you right. can, it'll come down pretty quickly. And the idea of the sun. So, you know, it's such a unique thing that we can do as humans, is that we can make vitamin D from the sun, but we have this, you know, skin cancer, public health skin cancer awareness. A lot of people wear a ton of sunscreen, or they don't go out in the sun, or they wear coverings, right? Like people wear the buffs, you've got the hood on your shirt, you know, the whole thing. So they don't get enough sun for it to create the appropriate healthful levels. The other issue is that being obese and overweight interferes with your ability to make vitamin D from the sun. So that's a factor, obviously, in our society, as well as, you know, there's certain medications, there's a lot of other things that just block that pathway. Of course, people with kidney issues, because the kidneys play a role in the steps to make vitamin D. So we definitely have this epidemic, whether it's related to COVID or not, we have an epidemic of low vitamin D status, and it's easy to go ignored because it's not always measured in routine blood work. You have to ask for it. It's one of those things where supplementation really does seem to be warranted for a vast majority of the population, and where you can't say the food first model, you know, because it doesn't apply. We just don't have a whole lot of it in our food supply, because we were never meant to get it from our food, you know, from a physiological perspective. And certainly I live in the Keys, and my boyfriend's a fishing guide. He has a charter. He's out in the sun all day, just like he's out there just like Joey, with no sunscreen or whatever. He still has low vitamin D.
Yeah.
Again, genetics, you know what? I don't know. Who knows?
Is he, I'm sorry, skin tone kind of fair still, or darker too? I know that.
Fair, blonde hair, blue eyes, pretty fair. Yeah.
Wow. Normally, so you would think that the penetration, right, closer to the equatorial latitude would be sufficient on a fair skin, but even under those circumstances, it's not, right?
Right. He's going to be so mad I admit it in public that he doesn't wear sunscreen. Yeah.
He doesn't wear it because he needs more vitamin D.
Despite my nagging, he's not wearing the sunscreen. Yeah.
I guess the trade-off of possible skin cancer and low vitamin D. I guess it is a trade-off. I mean, I go to a dermatologist every year, and they always say, do you wear sunscreen? And I say, well, no. And they're like, well, you should. And so we have this banter. It's the same banter every year for the last like 30 years. You put on sunscreen? No. Well, maybe you should. And they always comment, you look really dark. I'm like, always dark. But it's just kind of funny that every dermatologist says the same exact thing. And they never speak in trade-offs, that there's always a trade-off. If I put sunscreen, I will not get vitamin D unless I supplement, and I don't want to supplement with it because I get it for free.
Yeah.
You know? So, but I think that's the issue, you know, with clinicians in general, is that they don't really talk in terms of trade-offs, you know, like with the cholesterol thing, there's always trade-offs.
That's a really good point. You have to know, it goes back to our whole thing of like, these are complex interactions, right? The research looking at the connection between vitamin D and COVID-19 outcomes. The problem is few of those people only had low vitamin D.
Right.
Yeah. That's where it's like, people want, you know, grand conclusions from me. Is there a connection? Yeah. But is the connection isolated only to the low vitamin D status? I don't know. It's hard to say, because a lot of people, very few people, only have low vitamin D status, especially once they've got COVID and they're on a ventilator. Then they, you know, who knows what else is going on. So,
right.
Yeah, it becomes a hard thing to make conclusions of. But we do know vitamin D is important for our health. We do know that. We've got lots of angles. We know the receptors are there. You know, we've known for a long time. So it makes sense to make sure your levels are adequate, but you don't need to go overboard and be mega dosing it. So,
and you supplement versus sunshine?
Do I?
Yeah.
My levels are good. So no, oh. I don't supplement. Yeah, no, I think last time I got it done, it was like 55 or something like that. So
I don't know anyone who does have good levels. That's impressive.
Wait, so yours are at 55 with minimal sun and no supplementation.
Right. Yes. True. Now, I wouldn't say, I don't know if I'd say minimal sun. I do wear sunscreen, but I'm out in the morning when I go out running, like usually around sunrise. That first hour or two in the morning, I don't wear sunscreen then. And maybe I'm getting enough then, even though you're supposed to go out at peak hours. Maybe for me and my skin type, that's all I need. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Could be, could be. I want to switch topics because we're running out of time. You wrote this is a paper you wrote on disordered eating. And I just want to mention some statistics here and then we can talk from there. A systematic review reported lifetime prevalence rates of anorexia nervosa of 1.4% for women, 0.2% for men. For bulimia nervosa, 1.9% for women, 0.6% for men. And for binge eating disorder, 2.8% for women and 1% for men. When I first read that, I thought, wow, I thought it was a lot higher. Especially when you're around, if you're around endurance athletes, it's a lot higher than that. So it sort of reconciled, you know, my, I guess it's an anecdote, really, just who I've met versus the data.
Well, I would guess that a lot of the people that you're anecdotally, that all three of us anecdotally have been around, probably would meet the criteria of like disordered eating, right? So they wouldn't meet the strict criteria, the DSM-5 criteria for anorexia and bulimia. Far greater portion of the population, especially in endurance athletes, would suffer from disordered eating and would be subclinical, which are like subclinical diagnosable eating disorders, right? Because for athletes, a lot of times their weight might not be low enough to fit anorexia, or they might not binge often enough to fit the criteria. So the statistics are always going to be deceiving unless you broaden the scope and talk about disordered eating in general. And people with subclinical, people who, you know, sometimes starve themselves, sometimes binge, sometimes purge, or are just constantly focused on the next diet or this or that, or taking supplements for weight loss when they don't need to, focusing on it. That's a far greater portion of the population for sure.
Wait, so define disordered eating. What would be, I guess, a dictionary definition for that?
Well, disordered eating would be like subclinical anorexia, subclinical bulimia, over-focus on weight and appearance, like an over-focus on it, meaning...
Isn't that everybody we know?
But for the reason is, or the reason is that their self-worth, their self-identity, and that their whole, that this is who I am. And in other words, I'm not going to be liked. I'm not going to be loved. I am not a good person, right? I am... you know, this is who I am. And it's the point where it interferes with every other aspect of their life. So they're not eating appropriately from a caloric or a nutrient perspective. They're not supporting their performance goals with nutrition. They're, you know, under consumption, undue focus. And you raise a good point. There's a really fine line there between the performance athlete and this type of behavior. But it's the intent, the motivation, and then the comorbidities that go along with it. Like depression, anxiety, you know, it could be, but you know, sometimes it can be obsessive compulsive disorder, etc. So there's the, again, it's the full complex picture of it. And I think that what emerges is a lot of the groups that look at eating disorders, look at it again, from the black and white perspective, and they don't look at the full scope. So they would say, well, those people that you're talking about, they all have eating disorders and, you know, whatever. And so that's where the paper kind of came from, that is that, and I think you guys probably are aware of this, in several states, they've put forth legislation to ban access to certain dietary supplements for people under 18, in particular, like branched chain amino acids, protein, creatine. And they're saying that those particular supplements cause eating disorders. And that's why they need to be removed. And this is a group called Striped out of Harvard that has been the main driver of this legislative push.
Is there any data to support that?
No, but they if you look at their stuff, they take really old data, they take or studies that were done, and they look and they say, Well, people who have eating disorders are more likely to use dietary supplements. Well, okay, but that doesn't suggest causation. Yeah. That doesn't mean the supplements cause them, sure, because they're focused on their weight, right? And they're trying to take weight loss supplements or whatever. But they're using twisted information to drive this home. And what really got me about, I did my dissertation on eating disorder prevention. And when I had a practice, that was who I worked with. For 9 years when I was at Stetson, I had a private practice and I worked with people, athletes and non-athletes with eating disorders. So I was like, you know, here we are. This is, I've gotten away from that. I'm like 20 years down the line. I've been asked to revisit it. And I'm looking at this stuff and nothing's changed. We still don't have insurance coverage for people who need inpatient care. We still don't have general informed public awareness. And then I look at that group and I'm thinking to myself, it's because the people that say they're trying to promote those sort of messages are holding it back because they're saying things like protein supplements cause eating disorders. So I wrote the paper and in support, CRN supported the effort. And we've been utilizing it to provide it to legislators. Because again, they go to the legislators in the various states, which is the Save the Children message. So if you're trying to get reelected, I mean, what are you going to say? You don't know. You have no idea. You see these things and you're like, wait, really? It's protein? What is it? Creatine? Isn't that bad? I heard it's bad for kids. What? You know? So anyway, we're trying to inform legislators and basically putting out fires. And CRN and the other trade groups in the industry, like, you know, APA and CHIPA have really been very, very supportive of this and trying to inform lobbyists and inform the legislators. They had me get on the phone with one of the legislators in New Jersey and just try to be like, hey, this is not productive. Eating disorders are an issue, especially the subclinical kind. Let's all work together to find a solution, not this, because all you're doing is punishing the retailers who now have the extra burden to try to figure out, like, is this kid 18? I got to take an ID now. So now I'm not even going to sell the protein. Never mind. It's not good. And then what do you do about what teens are going into brick and mortar to buy this stuff anyway? What are we even talking about? They're buying it online. So it's just like a whole thing. And I felt like they're spreading messages that are incorrect about a really serious topic because eating disorders rarely occur, even if they're subclinical, like I said, by themselves. They usually occur with a lot of other comorbidities. And one of the high risks, of course, then becomes suicide. And so I just feel like it's a really serious issue for them to just be like, oh. And one of the things that motivates them to do this is funding. It's not a highly funded area. Right. So they're doing what they can. And it's usually emotionally funded. Unfortunately, someone who's lost a loved one to an eating disorder, et cetera. So that's what they banked the whole thing on. So that's where the paper came from.
Go ahead, Tony.
Just one quick question. And it could be a simple yes or no. So, I mean, I've seen the disease, it's god awful. It's one of the cruelest things that can happen to a person. It truly is. Have we made any, not maybe even advancements in prevention, but any advancements in at least arresting it or mitigating it once it occurs, or we not so much?
I would say it depends. Like, I think they've made a lot of progress with looking at anorexia and bulimia and being able to address it with, you know, some medications. And that's gone along with, it's mirrored our better understanding, you know, of the brain and how the brain, you know, and drugs that can impact or medications and therapy. But what is the saddest part of this disease for me, because I've seen it firsthand, are the thousands of women that go under the radar with it, that go decades where it runs their life and they're sad and their weight, what says on the scale dictates everything else in their life. And it holds back from productivity, right? It holds back from them reaching their full potential in their lives because again, they're not fueling their brain. They're focused on this. They feel depressed. They feel inadequate. And so to me, that's the greater loss. And I don't know that we've made progress in that side of it because it's one of those very unrecognized under the radar kind of things.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like that's the hole that still exists.
Okay.
I have two sort of random questions related to this. One, is there a similar prevalence of eating disorders in poor countries? So let's take Southeast Asia, Bangladesh, well, Vietnam is not quite as poor, but let's say poor countries. That's one. Number two, fighters making weight in the crazy stuff they do, would that be considered an eating disorder?
Oftentimes it is a trigger for an eating disorder and greater problems. They've really backed off a lot of that, right? Like the wrestling requirements, like how far you're allowed to drop weight for high school wrestling and things like that. There was I can't think of her name, but there was a researcher at Virginia Tech that did a lot of work with the high school wrestlers. And, you know, yes, it can be a huge trigger, a downward spiral towards one. And so that's why they've kind of changed a lot of that. But again, it comes down to why they're doing it and what's connected to it. So they're doing it just to make weight and then they're on their way and it's a deal. I mean, no. But it can often be a huge trigger for people who, you know, would something else have triggered them? Well, quite possibly. Right. Yeah. So yes and no is the answer. Right. As far as really, really impoverished countries around the world, we probably don't have the data, because my guess would be that if people have them there, they're not getting diagnosed. Right. And I also think for the subclinical part of it, there's a lot of cultural pressure and a lot of cultural stuff that gets into play, because it's a very complex and multidimensional thing. Whether you have, you know, subclinical or not, it's just very multidimensional. And so my guess would be no, because then we get into the whole Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Right. And the idea that you're focused on survival. There's no room for the rest of it. And you're not subject to that cultural pressure for appearance and all that stuff, because you're not even there. You're just worrying about whether you can live to see the next day or have food on your table and that kind of stuff. So my guess would be, we don't have the data, but if we get into developed countries, it's pretty similar globally. Mm-hmm. So it's a global challenge and issue.
Mm-hmm. I have one more question, Tony, unless you have one. I have one final.
No, please go.
Is there any data showing the prevalence of eating disorders by sport?
Yes.
So what does that show?
Exactly what you would think, right? Like appearance sports have the highest prevalence, like where they get judged on appearance, right? Like dance and gymnastics, and that kind of stuff. And then the endurance sports. Mm-hmm. And again, there have been progress in those areas. You know, a lot of coaches who pressured, you know, I had a friend who ran, I won't say where, but she ran for a top school that had women's track. And the coach was just lighter was faster. Just like, if you don't eat, you'll be lighter. She was 5'11" and he just like pushed her down to, I think, 107, something.
Whoa,
like that.
That's crazy.
And six girls on the team. In fact, a girl I went to high school with didn't make her Olympic trial because of it. Because that was like the mentality, like less, like, you know, girls are fatter. They have to be leaner. Leaner is better. With all, you know, just completely ignoring. And I think that the messaging has gotten out there where a lot of the coaching community is like, no, we're not. That's old school. That's bad. We're not doing that, you know, anymore. And we're going to encourage fuel your performance. And I think you can see it. Like, I was just looking at, you know, they've had a lot in the news about the gymnastics team, the current gymnastics team, mm-hmm. And looking at them, and those, they are fueled for performance, right? Those girls have, they're muscular. They're beautiful.
Yes.
They're not the tiny little waifs we used to see back in the day that you couldn't, like, how do they even have the strength to do what they're doing? And so I think, I'm hoping, and again, it's anecdotal, but I'm hoping that some of these coaches being outed in the media and stuff have made a difference in that regard for that that level of pressure.
Yeah, I, my wife, she ran track at Drake University. This is back in the 80s. So she was a pretty good middle distance runner. And the things they said to the girls back then would get you fired now. The coaches would say, tell girls they're fat. You guys lose weight if you want to win. And so I think all of them had an eating disorder because of that. So
yeah,
it's crazy what, you know, sort of the old school method of coaching, what, you know, what a lot of the past female athletes had to withstand, but now they're seeing the value of carrying a little bit more muscle, not under eating and seeing that, you know, being healthy. To me, if you're healthy throughout your college career, that's the big plus. It's, you see so many of these girls, they just get injured and they're under eating and are overtraining, and it's absolutely insane.
Yeah, it's a whole nother podcast in and of itself.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. Like, it's like, I mean, it's like they're constantly getting injured because they're not eating.
Yeah.
And then the injury puts him into a period of inactivity, which further exasperates, and it just goes back and forth. And then, of course, you know, the idea of like, well, being compared to men. And I think that we're like evolving out of that, where we're recognizing female athletes as female athletes, mm-hmm. not in comparison to men. And so I do think we've made, back to your original question that started this, is that, yes, I think we've made progress in a lot of ways. And it's come out of, it really has come out of the sports community, I think, a lot of the awareness. And unfortunately, yes, a lot of people had to suffer as a result of, for decades. Yeah.
Yeah. And I really hope so too, because that pressure pushed a lot of young women out of sport at a very early age because of that kind of pressure. It was horrible. They were 12-year-old gymnasts not allowed to eat. If you go back to, I'm not going to mention his name. We all know what, you know, the great U.S. gymnastics coach, but apparently the pressure was tremendous on these young women to essentially be toothpicks. And so now you're trying to participate in one of the most physically demanding sports of all time with the trauma, the forces on the bones, on the knees, and, you know, telling them they can't eat simultaneously. So one of the things that really bothered me, like I said about that, it had a permanent impact, or it knocked them out of the sport. So thankfully, I think in the last 20 years, we've pushed a lot of that away, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's made a big difference. And it's taken a lot of people to stand up. You know, you've certainly seen someone like Nadia Comaneci has come out and talked about it, and a lot of the American gymnasts and stuff. And I think that they're very brave to do that and made a big impact.
Yeah. It's been great.
So we are out of time. Could you tell the audience, if they want to reach you or if you want to be found, what's the, you're like, you cannot find me anywhere. Maybe go to LinkedIn if you want to send me a message that I will not read. No, I'm kidding.
I am very responsive on LinkedIn. You can email me. It's sue.hewlings@gmail.com. Pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And we know all the same peeps. Or you can come to ISSN in June and I'll be there.
Yeah.
So we'll all be there. I think you'll probably see a lot of sports science dudes there. I was looking at your list of interviewees and proud to be included. But yeah, that's the best place to find me. And I appreciate it, you guys.
No,
it
has been
thank
wonderful.
You, Dr. Ewlings. Thank you, Dr. Ricci, for being on the Sports Science Dudes. And
great information.
We'll have this podcast up in probably one day. So I'll send it to you. Thank
you. Awesome. Thank you, guys.